This is Nils Berzelius, Amherst class of 68, and we're talking today for Amherst Reads with Dan Goleman, also Amherst class of 68, about his new book, Ecological Intelligence, which is subtitled, How Knowing the Hidden Impacts of What We Buy Can Change Everything. How are you, Dan?
Good. It's good to be here virtually with you, Nils.
Well, it's my pleasure. I wanted to start out by noting that in addition to your fine undergraduate education at Amherst and Berkeley, you're also a Harvard-trained psychologist, and it's fair to say that you're best known for your writings about human behavior, both as a reporter for the New York Times for, 12 years, and as the author of several books, noticeably the best-selling Emotional Intelligence.
Yeah, Nils, like you, I found my way into journalism. It's a bit of a surprise for me. I don't know about you.
Well, I guess we both found our way in and then to some extent back out, but that's another story.
Right.
Your new book is also about human behavior, of course, but it takes you in a somewhat different direction from much of your past work. And perhaps you could tell us a little bit about how that came to be, what got you thinking about that topic, and I suppose there's a clue to that in the dedication of ecological intelligence.
Well, yeah, it was having grandchildren that really got me thinking about the state of the world and the world we're leaving to our children and children's children and to their children. And I went back to some work I had done actually before I wrote Emotional Intelligence. I wrote a book called Vital Lies, Simple Truths. The phrase vital lie comes from Ibsen, the Norwegian playwright, who used it to talk about the half-truths we tell ourselves in order to avoid facing a more painful truth that lies underneath. And in the 80s, when I wrote that book, I noted in passing that the biggest collective vital lie was that although we decried the environmental crises of the day, and then it was clear-cutting the Amazon, you know, for beef farms and acid rain. Even though we were upset about those, we made really zero connection between the meltdown of planetary systems and our daily habits. And in fact, we are the drivers through human systems of energy and transportation and industry and commerce. We've actually entered the Anthropocene age, a geological era which started in the Industrial Revolution, where one species, you and me and the rest of us, is driving the major biogeochemical systems that sustain life on the planet in the wrong direction. And I got interested in the topic again, I think, for those emotional reasons, but then as a science journalist, I was intrigued to hear that there were new information systems emerging that, in a sense, filled the gap, that made the connection between, say, what we buy when we go to the store and what the actual ecological impact of those very items is. And this was the big aha for me. I felt now we have a mechanism that can help you and me take more responsibility for our individual choices and consequences for the planet.
Well, stop for a second there, Dan, and you say new mechanisms. What's an example of that? What are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about information systems in commerce and industry. One is what they call consumer-facing. That is, you and I, when we go shopping, can now know immediately, as we're sitting there, standing there in the aisle of the store, is this toy ecologically superior to that toy? Or what's the, this pasta sauce or this electronic device? And the reason is there's a new generation of info systems. The state of the art right now is called Good Guide. One word, Good Guide, G-U-I-D-E. .com. It's a website, it's an app on the iPhone, and it aggregates about 200 databases about the environmental and health and social impacts of products and the companies that make them, and sums that up in a single score on a 10-point scale, 10 being the best. So you can immediately compare any class of products. They now rate about 65,000 and more coming. And that changes the game. This creates what economists call information symmetry, as opposed to asymmetry, where the seller knows something, the buyer doesn't. all of a sudden, companies are finding that consumers can know in a sound and deep way and comprehensive way the ecological consequences of what they're buying. And that changes, as I say in the book title, that can change everything.
So obviously there's huge potential there, but do you think many people are actually taking advantage of this, using their cell phone apps, iPhone apps, to make these decisions on the spot? Seems to me we still very often are misled by what really is not such good information that's really more the product of what marketers want us to think than what a valid, meaningful database would tell us.
Well, I think you raised two really important points. One is about greenwashing and the other about motivation. How many shoppers really care enough to make the effort to find out the data and to apply it in their decisions? And let me start with that first. Right now, it's a very relatively small number. Consumer surveys show that about 10% of shoppers are passionate enough to make the effort to use information like this and let it sway their purchase decisions. About a third couldn't care less, and maybe two-thirds are in the middle. They say, I'd use the information if it were easy to get. The intriguing thing about GoodGuide is that many retailers, including, of all people, Walmart, are now talking about developing sustainability indices or using GoodGuide and putting the score right next to the price tag. And other similar rating systems, for example, for nutrition in the Hannaford Brothers stores in Maine, has shown that if you do that, you set up what's called a nudge situation, where it's very easy to nudge people to use the system. And indeed, with Hannaford Brothers, simply having nutritional ratings right next to the price tag has shifted market share toward the more nutritious products. And that itself can set up what's called a virtuous cycle, where transparency in the marketplace gives customers information that's easy to use, that they apply, that makes one company lose market share and another gain, which in turn creates a business case for companies to chase that market share. And in this case, it gives muscle to sustainability, which is often spoken of as something virtuous to do in business circles and in companies, but is hard to make a hard case for until now. And that's why I think these information systems could be quite pivotal in accelerating companies' move toward sustainability. And this brings up the question of greenwashing. If you use the kind of state-of-the-art lens on a product's sustainability and eco-impact, it's something called life cycle assessment, which is done by a new discipline called industrial ecology. Industrial ecology assesses in a very hard-nosed way the impacts of human systems on nature and on natural systems, and it comes up with metrics that give you a very fine detail on, for example, a glass jar through this lens has 1,959 discrete steps over its life cycle, from the time you started to extract the sand that you're going to mix with other elements and heat it to thousands of degrees for 24 hours and make glass and on through the entire life cycle. Well, you see, if you have 1,000 steps in the life cycle of a single product and you improve one thing and therefore call it green, that's really smoke and mirrors. We should be talking about a perpetual upgrade of continually getting greener, where we improve or work in improving every one of the major impacts, rather than just taking a thin slice and saying, oh, well, here it is, it's green, and we're going to market it that way.
So I guess you're saying it really doesn't take vast numbers of individual consumers to use this kind of information more effectively, but the mere fact that it's out there and that some people start to respond starts to have a feedback effect on the people who make products and gets them thinking about, as you say, improving their market share by behaving in virtuous ways.
Well, exactly. I was talking to someone at Yale who studies this, and he says that the tipping point is somewhere around 10 to 15% market share. That if you're losing or gaining in that magnitude, it's consequential enough that it should drive strategy. And to the extent that sustainability itself becomes a pivot point for losing or gaining, then I think that will give great momentum to the moves within business in corporate social responsibility and so on. People are arguing that sustainability should be strategy, but haven't yet been able to make the hard business case.
Well, as you know, Dan, I now work for an outfit called Environmental Working Group in Washington, D.C., which whose slogan is the power of information. And EWG, as we call ourselves, has long been based on the concept of assembling information in databases, making it easily searchable and analyzable, and putting it on the web so that consumers can look up products that they use all the time, such as cosmetics, sunscreens, foods to find out what kind of pesticide residues they may carry. And we're fortunate enough to get you to write several blogs for our website based on the book. This all seems to be going in a similar direction.
Well, I feel that Environmental Working Group is one of the prime movers in this space. I'm a big fan of one of your websites. It's called Skin Deep, which does something quite wonderful. It looks at all of the individual ingredients in personal care products. You know, there can be 50 in a shampoo. And researches them in medical databases to see, well, have they proven to be carcinogens in rats, or are they asthmogens, or might they be endocrine disruptors, on and on. And then rates them accordingly so that you can see which sunscreen or which shampoo and so on is safe and which is not. And I think this is vitally important for our own personal health and for the health of our families and the people we love. The new thinking in medical etiology is that the mix that we all carry inside ourselves, it's called the body burden. The CDC is doing studies where they we'll take a blood sample of people at random, and what you find is that we all carry in our tissues, we store the cumulative effects of very small exposures to any of the, you know, tens of thousands, actually now I think 80,000 industrial chemicals now in use in products today. And something like Skin Deep levels the playing field. It gives us information, which is ammunition, so that we can arm ourselves when we go shopping and buy the safer products. So I applaud what you're doing.
Well, it's interesting. If we could take this down to the level of individual choice just for a second, I perhaps might use myself as an example. As I mentioned, one of the things that EWG does is a shopper's guide, which tests foods, various foods, produce for pesticide contamination. And I'm sad to find that some of my favorite things, for instance, strawberries and now blueberries, turn out to have fairly high levels of pesticide residues, and things that I'm a lot less likely to eat, at least for breakfast, like an onion, come out the best. And so I find myself debating with myself, how do I navigate this decision between preference and a sense of what's good for me?
I know. We have to... I mean, this is the problem with piercing a vital lie. There are these painful truths underneath. And, you know, if you slice an onion really thin and put it in an omelet, maybe with some tomato sauce or, some flavoring, it's not so bad, really.
But on my cereal, I don't know. I actually like onions, but it's in their place.
Exactly. But these are the new dilemmas, and I think they're healthier dilemmas, frankly, because they're based on the truth.
Mm-hmm. So do you find yourself struggling with decisions like that?
Well, it's definitely more my breakfast, now that you mention it. I happen to like berries, and I try to buy organic berries just because you avoid the pesticide problem. And it is pricier, that's true. And I have started to make an omelet actually with onions in it. Mm-hmm. But there are ways to make that okay, too.
So getting back to your book, Dan, which I read, obviously, it does seem in the end that you're very optimistic about the direction that things are taking. Having both of us graduated from schools quite a few years ago and seen how things that sometimes looked like they were going in a good direction turn out not to work out that well, do you really feel as optimistic as your book suggests?
Well, I do for two reasons. One is I think that these information systems are getting more and more backing. I'm just going to later this week to the EPA for a meeting about one of these systems, which is for supply chain management. It's called Earthster, like Napster, Earthster, which is an open source system that will help companies rate their suppliers on their ecological impacts and to create industry standards that will help companies make the decision that they will face if this does become a critical competitive battlefield, which is, should we use this chemical or that chemical, this supplier or that this industrial platform or another, and what will we gain in terms of eco impacts and ratings in the marketplace? And I've noticed that the interest in systems like this, just in the couple of years I've been tracking it, is increasing exponentially. Part of that is driven by this announcement by Walmart that they're going to demand that their suppliers, and they have 100,000 plus, provide this kind of data. And that is an earthquake in retail and in industry, because it means that everybody needs that piece of business in Walmart. And if you do it, you have to start using these methodologies and providing the information, which will create a kind of a data commons, if you will, that will make the work you're doing and the work other folks are doing with consumer rating systems even easier. That's one thing. I think that the information systems are going to continue to improve. And the other is that younger people are passionate about this. I think that there's, when we went to school, we had a unique generational trauma, the civil rights movement and the Vietnam War. And I think that the 60s certainly shaped our collective view in various ways, individual ways, of course, but still, single events had enormous generational impact. And for children today, the unique trauma is the steady stream of headlines about the meltdown of the systems that sustain life on the planet. And kids are growing up with the idea that the world is not going to be as nice in many decades as it is now, and it's going to get worse and worse and worse for us as we go through life and for our children and for their children. So I think that young people, as they grow into maturity and become consumers and captains of industry and so on, will feel in their hearts that this matters.
So you feel that even though younger people are well known for their feelings basically of immortality, which led some of us to take risks we never should have, nevertheless, that these kinds of perceptions about the way the world is going actually get through that sense that, hey, nothing can ever happen to me?
Well, I think you lose that sense that, any risk is no risk at all as you age, particularly as you get children yourself, have children yourself. So I think that with maturity, the original trauma will stick and the way you relate to it will change. I think that's true of every generation. So, yeah, I think that kids today, as they go through life, will apply the importance of this in decisions across the board. What they bring into their house, how much they buy, what they buy, how they make things if they go into business, what they sell, and so on. So I think that this will become a norm rather than just 10%.
Well, it's certainly true that they grow up today just almost from kindergarten age with a comfort level and an awareness of their ability to get information that dwarfs anything we could have imagined. I mean, maybe it starts out all about music and entertainment, but they certainly are comfortable from a very early age with knowing that they can get online, they can go to their iPhones or whatever, and just find out things almost instantaneously that, as I say, we would have found unimaginable.
Well, I was mentioning this good guide to my 9-year-old nephew. I was stunned. He he doesn't have an iPhone. He's not old enough to have a phone. He has an iPod. But when he found out it was a free app, he downloaded it on his iPod, and, you know, he was addicted to it. And I think these systems like Skin Deep and other systems that offer this information are going to be taken up by kids because it's more natural for them. They know the tech world. They're comfortable in it. I'm a big advocate now of teaching these kinds of metrics, this new math, if you will, the LCA and so on, in schools as part of eco-literacy, because I think as kids understand more directly the consequences of their personal decisions for their health, for the planet, they'll make better decisions.
To what extent is that happening in schools?
Well, almost every school now has environmental studies and, you know, field trips into the local stream and parks and forests to understand the local ecosystem. But I think the next stage in this is to see that local decisions have global consequences, to see that it's not just, you know, how we manage water in our community, but that everything we buy impacts an ecosystem or ecosystems around the world. And this is having global consequences. So we need to help kids make more intelligent connections between local decisions and global consequences.
And obviously you feel good enough by seeing the kind of behavior your nephew exemplifies that this really is happening. It's not just a fond hope.
Well, I tend to be an optimist, Nils, so I see it as a promising data point. But, of course, we'll see.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a very good note to finish this conversation on, Dan, and I certainly hope that this kind of thinking with help provided by both your book and perhaps by some of the work we do here at EWG will continue to spread and continue to change the world in positive ways.
Well, exactly, Nelson. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and I want to thank you for your good work.
Well, thank you, Dan.